You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we don't inject stem cells into our dicks. Our dicks inject stem cells into you.
No!
Think about it. It's actually true if you think about it. Just think about it. Stop. I'm your host, Justin M. Wozdeski, and if you have a problem with my joke about stem cells and dicks, then stop listening to this show and don't tell a friend about it. But if you laughed like James laughed, please tell a friend. Wear who you want here in the midside, and also support more of our stem cell dick jokes at themidside.com/Patreon or patreon.com/themidside. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, just off the tarmac, Daniel T. Richards.
Boy, that was close. Flight lands 30 minutes early, and I end up getting off the plane 45 minutes late. So... thank you, government-run airports, for the most part, and your ridiculous regulations, for that nonsense. Also, are people going to find jokes funny when they haven't heard the story they're referring to yet?
Thank you for instructing us in Communication 101.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They don't need to know about the joke. Right? That's the esoteric point. If they get the joke, it makes it even funnier. Now we're explaining humor and they're in the opening, but they don't need to get the joke. They don't need to know what that's based on because the flip makes it funny because it's absurd.
I know that you're into esoteric humor, but when the total population of people who get your esoteric joke is 4, it's a little too esoteric.
Eh, it's fine.
Okay.
What Daniel's referring to is there's a story of a dude who wanted to make his dick bigger, so he inserted stem cells into it. That's the entire story.
Yes. Introduce James.
Also joining us, okay. And he has something to say about that story, from the hills of white privilege, James Elias.
So, Justin, the stem cells that come out of your dick, are they pluripotent or are they omnipotent?
Oh.
Well, I'm assuming they're not omnipotent because they're not God. So, and I don't know what the other word means. What's the other word? Pluripotent?
Pluripotent. Can your stem cells turn into any part of the body, or can they only turn into some parts of the body?
Oh, so you don't mean omnipotent. You mean omnipotent.
It's omnipotent.
No, they're omnipotent because they can impregnate anyone, man or woman.
Exactly. That's what I figured. But really, they're omnipotent because they can also change reality with just their mind.
Right.
Yeah, that story. I mean, the story is about this guy who he's a biohacker, blogger, or a health hacker, a body hacker. He tried just to do all these tricks to improve the performance of his body. And I don't know, that's sort of a cool idea, but I don't know. I mean, you would imagine that the majority of people who do stuff like this they kind of do some stupid stuff. And so he's gone to this clinic in Florida and gotten his dick filled up with a bunch of stem cells. And apparently he says it's going great for him. His dick is bigger now is what he claims. And the FDA is and this article talks about the FDA. This article kind of pissed me off because it, even though this guy probably is an idiot, it casts the innovator as a crazy moron who's trying to do stuff with his dick based on no scientific evidence. And then it casts the FDA as the reasonable one, which is just a really damaging thing for our culture. For every 1,000 idiots there are putting stuff into their pee holes, there's one guy who comes up with some sort of life-saving cure that helps billions of people. So this is exactly the attitude we don't want to have in the field of science.
You know what you just described, James? false dichotomy, bro.
Yeah, and what's the false dichotomy?
Well, the false dichotomy is the idea that one side is reasonable and one side is not reasonable. Yeah, I mean, right. Isn't the history of inventions just dudes trying to do ridiculous things with their dicks until one of them did something that worked?
No, because, right. I mean, the one reasonable guy who, no, but, Justin, the reasonable guy wasn't just trying stuff. The reasonable guy who actually got somewhere, you know, had a lot of thinking that went into his decision. And, you know, maybe he did something extreme. Maybe he, you know, for example, injected himself with a disease and then cured himself with his own cure to prove that his cure would work. Maybe he did something a little crazy like that, but that crazy thing was based on his own scientific confidence. This
wasn't
guy's
that
just
an episode of House, Daniel?
I think so. I was going to say, now we know where that kite was tied to before Franklin tried that key.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. You're 100%
correct. That explains
correct.
our diplomatic policy throughout the entire Civil War or the entire Revolutionary War, basically.
Shocking.
Franklin's dick getting a lock. Shocking. Exactly.
Well, I'm glad you didn't shit on his joke after you shit all over mine. So I think it's just time we move on to things we can actually all enjoy shitting on together. It's time for the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Usually a great transition into the news. In this case, awkwardly placed. As Northeastern University study reports that schools are safer than they were in the 90s and school shootings are not more common than they used to be. Don't want to take a poop on that point. Okay. Found this study interesting because it's contrary to a lot of what's been going around in the news and the talk of why we need to make our schools safer and safer and safer and we need gun control in order to do that well. As we like to do on this show often, we like to set the context. In fact, I think that could almost be its own sub-segment in the news, which is set the context. So this study looked
needs a better name. Okay. That's not a very catchy name for a segment.
Okay, let's call it Inject This Into Your Wherever. Okay, here's how the article starts. The deadly shooting this month in Parkland, Florida has ignited national outrage and calls for action on gun reform, but while certain policies may help decrease gun violence in general, it's unlikely that any of them will prevent mass school shootings, according to James Allen Fox, the Lippmann Family Professor of Criminology, Law, and Public Policy at Northeastern University. Since 1996, there have been 16 multiple victim shootings in schools, or incidents involving four or more victims and at least two deaths by firearms. Of these, eight are mass shootings, or incidents involving four or more deaths, excluding the assailant. Essentially, the conclusion of the study is this is not an epidemic. In research published later this year, Fox and doctoral student Emma Friedel found that on average, mass murders occur between 20 and 30 times per year, and about one of these incidents on average takes place at school, and in fact, it is no more violent than it was in the 90s, and in fact, the 90s were the most violent decade for these kinds of things. So things are getting safer. Justin, will this matter to anyone?
No, it won't, because people just want to tell the stories they want to tell. And I think what has gotten worse in our society is that we're more controlled by the media now than we ever were before. I mean, we could speculate to the reasons as far as everyone being connected all the time and social media and so on and so forth. But it's people want to only hear what supports their view of the world and what's going on. And when we're definitely talking about the trauma of what's going on right now, it's comforting in a weird way to be like, oh yeah, Parkland wasn't a weird isolated incident. This is something that's happening all the time. Because rather than things being random and you just can't combat against them. So if think about it this way, if Parkland was random, there's nothing we can really do to stop it, you know, besides the FBI and the police doing their jobs. But that, let's not go into that again, right? We don't want me to have an aneurysm in this episode. But there's nothing you can really do. It's just a random event, right? Like, shit happens, right? Like, I can be driving and I can get plowed into by a tractor trailer tomorrow and die. that could happen. And there's nothing I can do to protect him against that, no matter how well I drive, how poorly I drive. Like, that's just a random statistical event. Same thing with a plane crash, right? This is why some people are afraid of plane crashes. There's nothing you can do if you're in the air and your plane just fucks up and you go down and you die. It's completely out of your control. So the idea that this is happening often and it's a trend that's growing makes people feel comfort because they feel like there's some control that can be exercised over it. And the media feeds into that because that gives the media views and clicks or however, whatever fucking ridiculous metric they're using nowadays. So no, nobody's going to care about this because we will always care. And this goes back to what James was saying last episode. We will always care about our emotions over reality. Our emotions right now trump our minds. And that is what is going on. And that's why this study will be ignored.
And in today's day and age, with the president we have now, literally our emotions are trumping our minds.
Thank you. You've now shit on one of my jokes and explained one of my jokes.
Yeah, I guess that didn't need to be like really pointed out.
2-4-2. James, one of the things that's interesting about this study versus what the media reported immediately afterwards and what they continued to report after the Parkland shooting is the discrepancy in numbers. Why do we continue, and this is hopefully a softball for you, James, just a little lob of a pitch that you can knock out of the park here. Why do we continue to have such drastic, radical differences in something that should be fairly empirical, like the number of school shootings?
I don't know, just because there's different agendas. Is that kind of, it may seem like you'll have to hit your own pitch here. Like, because it's just, if there's a particular agenda someone has, they, you know, if they're dishonest, they're going to not really care about the numbers and interpret it that way. Is that sort of what you're referring to? Or are you getting at something else?
That's pretty much
I know what he's referring to.
Well, I'm referring to a couple things, but the one I wanted you to talk about was simply that we pick our numbers and basically our definitions of things based on our agenda and not on any sort of tie with reality. So when, was it Senator Sanders tweeted out there had been like 18 school shootings this year, and like one of them was a police officer at a school giving a demonstration and his gun accidentally went off, but no one was injured. That counts as a school shooting. A guy in a parking lot at a school at night shot and killed himself, committed suicide. That counted as a school shooting. You can go down the list, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
You know what I feel like I'm listening to right now, Daniel? Feel like I'm listening to the Adam and Dr. Drew show.
Yeah. I mean, look, to be fair, all these things were in the news. And so I saw it independent of that show. Thank you, though.
Right, but this is what when I said I knew what you were talking about, this is exactly what they talked about on, and that's what Adam Kroll was talking about. It's what you're talking about is the same thing, this midwittery with language, where we're using the word school shooting to make things seem worse than they are. So these are school shootings, right? A gun went off in a school, so that's technically a school shooting. But that's not what these school shootings like Parkland mean. So where what's the when you confuse two things like that on purpose? What's the word? Yeah, we're equivocating on purpose to scare people and to give them the comfort to get the clicks, the views, or whatever fucking metric you're using. Am I wrong?
Yeah,
I think you're exactly right.
It's disgusting.
It's abhorrent because it undermines the sort of general trust not only in the media, which is already gone, but in quote unquote science, when he says like, well, we started a study that said there have been 18 school shootings this year. Well, if people are going to just see these studies over and over again that seem completely contrary to what they know about the world, then what other choice do they have to conclude that science is crap and I don't need to follow it? That's why it's such a horrifying, use of science and research to use it purely to forward your nonsense political agenda. It's doubly horrible.
Right. Eventually, all we're going to do is, if we're rational and healthy, trust our own minds. So we're going to trust what we see in the world and what we deduce from that. Or I should rather say what we induce from that. So we're going to look at the trends ourselves and say, this is what we think. And we're going to trust no expert outside of ourselves, no other person, and that's the true breakdown of society. You've made communication impossible because you're not communicating about anything anymore.
Yeah, it's like there's no longer a sort of informational division of labor that's so required for carrying on the functions of an intellectual society we have now.
And, of any society. It's not just intellectual. Any society requires a differentiation of intellectual labor, of information.
Well, right. I mean, but I'm talking specifically about, like, the scientific society we have now, as opposed to the Roman Empire, which was, like, you know, pretty organized and stuff, but not very scientific. And we would strongly prefer the scientific society we have now as opposed to something like the Roman Empire. It's a lot better now. But my question is that as this trust just continues to erode, well, my question is not whether the trust is eroding or not. Like, as you guys have noticed, like, we're seeing story after story that, like, further erodes it. My question is just, where are we at now? Like, when scientists say something that has any political implication whatsoever, how seriously does it get taken anymore? Because, you know, as we're about to find out with the with our hopeful romantic, our trailer takedown, I cannot read out the context of politics out of almost anything now. Just the fact that I'm afraid of some kind of distortion. Just even, I mean, it's even in our movies now, and, like, I mean, that feels obvious, but I mean, it's to a degree where it never before has. It's in our science. It's in our movies. It's about what we say to one another. It just makes it hard. Every aspect of communication has now been affected by the lies, and as a result, we don't trust each other anymore, making communication just fundamentally harder in so many contexts. So yeah, that's,
we're so woke now that it's basically become insomnia. Like, there's no rest from this. It is everywhere.
I like where you went there, but I thought you were going to say we're so woke now that it's become a joke.
I like the insomnia thing, because, like, because we're so woke, we haven't slept, and now we can't even reason.
Now we're going delirious. Because we aren't
getting enough REM sleep.
And, no, I think the insomnia thing is a great metaphor. I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and swap a story here to have a little bit of synergy. And not swap in a new story, but to say essentially that to continue on this science political nonsense, do you hate your body odor? You're more likely to have right-wing views. Yes. The subtitle of this Guardian piece is "Scientists Suggest Authoritarian Attitudes May Be Partly Rooted in Biological Urge to Avoid Catching Diseases from Unfamiliar People." Man, that subheading has all of the key points in it, doesn't it? Just hammers it in there. Okay. The article. This is from a newspaper, everyone. This is from The Guardian, which is, quote-unquote, one of the better newspapers remaining on the planet. Okay. People who have and this is woke, by the way. Okay. People who have a greater tendency to turn up their nose at the whiff of urine, sweat, and other body odors are more likely to have right-wing, authoritarian attitudes, research suggests. The study also found having a greater disgust for body odors was linked, albeit to a small degree, with support for, guess who, Donald Trump, when he was a presidential candidate. The team say the finding supports the idea that feeling of disgust might partly underpin social discrimination against others, with the link rooted in a primitive urge to avoid catching diseases from unfamiliar people or environments. Justin, does this mean that the left literally likes the smell of their own butthole?
I mean, I think Trey Parker and Matt Stone established that well years ago in the Smog episode of South Park, did they not?
They did. I loved the wine glasses that they would flatulate into and then swirl around and sniff. That was a particularly disgusting bit of satire. That was hilarious.
Yes. A great episode. It really nailed it. And they've nailed many other things in the show. And another episode this makes me think of is the hippie episode. And all of this, the hippie episode, the smug episode, this story, just gives me a great sense of sorrow. And it's the great sense of sorrow at the false dichotomy, bro, of our society. The first thing is, can we get rid of this idea that the right wing is the only authoritarian wing? Like, are we not to the point that we see both the left and right wing are authoritarian at this point? So I wish we'd stop saying that. But that's a minor squabble in all of this. I really hate the idea that human development and self-esteem are being linked with only the right wing, and they're being linked with a negative form of government such as authoritarianism. And what I mean by it is, oh my God, is it such a bad thing to socially discriminate against people because they smell? Because that smell is a negative thing, and our body biologically responds and goes, wow, that smell is really gross. Like, am I supposed to, let me put it this way. When you go camping, and so did anyone ever go camping as a kid? And they're like, go shit in the outhouse. But this outhouse keeps all the human compost in it, and then we use that. So when you go in there, you nearly want to puke. There's a reason our shit smells, and we've developed not to go near that. So now that's associated with the right wing and associated with authoritarianism. So you can't just socially discriminate, which, by the way, everyone discriminates for any number of reasons. Discrimination is fine. It's what you discriminate on is the problem. But now if you discriminate on good things such as health, you want to be around healthy people, and you want to stay healthy yourself, you're now an authoritarian? Stories like this and studies like this, beyond the politics, which I agree, James, I agree with everything you said, but beyond that, there is a greater problem here. The idea that we're breaking down human development just on the basic level of what is good for life on an immediate physical, biological level. Now I have to support Trump if I don't want to be around people who smell? Like, it's just, it's insane.
It is fairly insane. James, this is sound science, right?
Yeah. I mean, don't even get me started on the science part. I mean, I'm past the point of being interested in criticizing the science behind this, or the, you know, whatever you'd call this crap, the crap methodology that led to this. But what I find interesting here is when you talk about other people as being, you know, something as deep as their, you know, political beliefs as being fundamentally determined by some kind of biological factor like this, you're just fundamentally dehumanizing other people. And I mean, this further gets to the inability to communicate with one another. If you're on the left and you're literally reading these studies and as a result not thinking of people on the other side as rational beings, you're literally dehumanizing them. Like, what does it mean to dehumanize someone? To not treat them as human? Well, to not treat them as a rational animal. For fuck's sake. Like, I mean, you've been seeing this for a while, these sort of studies where, you know, it's like, oh, well, of course we know that, like, you know, political beliefs aren't caused by, you know, considerations, any kind of like actual thought process. It's just, you know, your biology that just deterministically leads you to some particular position on these issues.
Right. It's because they're inverting it. Right. And they're inverting what they're calling authoritarianism. So yeah, it tends to be that people say, right. People tend to say that people on the right are more about structure and authority and, you know, trusting the development of society and capitalism and blah, blah, blah. So therefore, they're going to want people to be more civilized, whereas people on the left, that's why they like hippies and stuff, because they say they're more free and accepting and tolerant. But that's what I'm talking about. Why is tolerance like tolerating people who are harmful to you? Do you get what I'm saying? Like, yeah. And the fact that this is linked with right and left is just insane to me. And then it becomes authoritarian. There's just so much wrong with this article.
Yeah, this is just one more example. And I think this is a particularly good example of the lies that the left has produced are now so incredibly pervasive. And I mean, this isn't to let the right off the hook, because they have all of these counter lies, but it really is the left that started it. That's the only reason that I talk about it as the left. Like, there are so many lies just floating around that were produced by the left that are just taken for granted now. And people don't even question them. And you could see a lot of those faulty assumptions just built into this article. There's tons of people who are going to just accept, say this as science, like, oh, well, that must have something to do with it. And unbeknownst to them, they've now accepted like 30 implicit lies that are, you know, implicitly in this article. It's so insidious, and it puts me on guard continuously against this sort of stuff.
That's right.
Just become a big therapy session for me, where I just vent all my anxieties. Just like my mind is under constant attack, and you guys on the mid side, everyone on the mid side, you have to help me. We have to help each other. We got to get through this.
What is this? Your third season on the show, and you're finally getting the premise?
I guess I'm just discovering new levels of the premise the longer I go, Justin.
It's that deep, Justin. The midside is that deep. Really, I especially get nervous when people like who are what is this? Professors of social psychology weigh in. It's like, oh, well, I know this is bunk. Excellent. I get to move on. Yeah. Because there is no such thing as social psychology.
Talk about an oxymoron. Yeah. Social psychology?
Yes. Professor of social psychology. Is that not something in Atlas Shrugged? Is there not a professor of social psychology in Atlas Shrugged? At some point now, I just lean over to people and I go, so those Ayn Rand characters unbelievable now? Or what are you thinking? Because in like 10 years, it's going to look like she was pulling punches. Just going to be hysterical.
Right. Right. That'll be.
I don't know. For me, it was always like when I remember the dinner party or whatever, the anniversary party, and those conversations, I was like, yeah, that was pretty much my undergrad. That's what everyone at my undergrad sounded like.
Well, yeah,
so.
But you were a time traveling astronaut who went to Ithaca and experienced what the future would be. So
that's not completely true.
He's already been to the future and come back.
That's right.
Except there's one minor difference that makes it tolerable to me.
Yeah.
I have sex now.
There you go. Well, speaking of discrimination and things we can't discriminate against anymore, because we're all going to be in the same category here. One more shift in the story here, guys. Millennials are set to be the fattest generation. Great headline. Based on population trends, more than 7 in every 10 people born between the early 80s and mid-90s will be too fat by the time they reach middle age. In comparison, about half of the baby boomer generation born just after World War II were fat at that age. Being fat as an adult is a link to 13 types of cancer. This includes bowel, kidney, breast, but only about 15 people in the UK are aware of the link. So basically, obesity is increasing and young people don't care. And I'm wondering, Justin, why it is that they don't care. Why is it that millennials just don't give a shit about being fat?
Ooh, interesting direction you took this in. Why don't they care? They don't care because everything they want is at their fucking fingertips, right? I mean, we sort of talked about this with the sexodus.
Doritos.
Why do you need to worry about being in shape and getting sex if you can just go click, click, red tube, watch people fucking? Right? Why do you need to worry about it if you can just Postmates, Taco Bell delivered? Why do you need to be in shape? It's not a surprise to me, this statistic, this story, because we are now at a time when to go outside and play with your friends, you don't even need to do that. You just all sign on to Battlefront and you're playing with each other and you're talking to each other. It used to be when we were young. And I'm still early 80s, but I still did this, I guess, because I grew up in small town America. I don't know. Whatever. But you would have to go and you have to get off the couch and knock on the next door. Can Brian come out to play? And that's how you actually have to move to go and play with someone. Now, you don't even do that. You just like send a ping or some shit and everyone gets on their PS4 or Xbox 860 and they start yelling at each other like children while they're playing Battlefront and fake shooting each other. Like, it's not a surprise because of that. And also, that's the same reason they don't care. Everything is at their fingertips. Everything.
One thing that a professor said in here that I was surprised that he sort of said it in the wake of the body positivity movement or whatever it's called, is that he's afraid that being overweight is becoming normalized because so many people struggle with it and then don't recognize it in each other. But it's also because, as Adam Carolla talks about, we don't really shame anywhere, at least not in this sense. We shame in many other dumb senses now. But James, do you think the body positivity or fat shaming or fat acceptance movement is adding to this, or is that just sort of icing on the very fat cake?
You give him that question?
Yeah.
That's the question you give him?
I'm mixing it up.
Yeah, go ahead. What?
I'm mixing it up.
Yeah, I mean, that obviously is going to have a factor. If we talk about how, you know, factor. Standards of beauty... Well, that's obviously going to be a factor. That's obviously... It might... You guys are thinking it's the factor. I've actually read some stuff that maybe there's other factors involved, just involving the way we eat and what we choose to eat. But I mean, this is clearly a factor because, you know, biological standards of beauty are based on some facts. There are healthy body sizes and there are unhealthy body sizes. You know, just as your body is giving you some, you know, a warning sign when you smell shit, like, hey, don't go over there, you could get a disease. Your body's also telling you warning signs when it makes you unattracted to a fat woman, saying, don't put your dick in that, you know, otherwise the kids may not be as strong. That's, you know, it's just, our standards of beauty have real facts behind it. You know, sorry.
James.
And these facts, what's up?
What do you think of Amy Schumer?
I don't.
Oh. Man. I mean, that's a proper response, but I was hoping that since you were getting my question, I was hoping you would go on my rant for me.
Well, what do you think,
Justin,
about Amy Schumer, Justin?
Do you also want to respond to the question?
No, it's fine. I mean, it's everything James was saying. I would just use Amy Schumer as an exemplar of that. Amy Schumer is an exemplar of that. That's all.
I guess that's what I've become. I'm now the Amy Schumer.
That's right. And to be clear, James, I'm not sure I think that the body acceptance or positivity is the primary driver. I think it is a driver. I think it will increase to be a driver. But it's really the sort of psychological response to the fact that people make bad decisions. They're looking for any way to justify their bad decisions. And this whole anti-shaming movement gives them a huge out, which is, I'm just naturally, you know, fat is beautiful, and this is just how my body is as I eat 1920s. Yeah. Like, it's all ridiculous.
Well, yeah, it goes back to the first story where people will believe what gives them comfort. So even if it's comfort as the ship sinks, they'll take that over, you know, actually trying to get off the ship.
That's right. Listening to
at least
if you just tell everyone, there are no life preservers, we can't survive. There are no life preservers, we can't survive. If you tell everyone that, they'll go, well, that's okay. I guess we just got to go down. There's nothing we can do. It wasn't our fault. Rather than, oh shit, there are no life preservers, let's figure out a way to get off this. That's what it is. I mean, it goes back to what I was saying about the Taco Bell. If you're ordering Taco Bell on Postmates or Uber Eats or whatever the other one, I can't remember it is. I don't want to like be helping any one company here. But if you're using any of these delivery services to order Taco Bell or Del Taco or whatever your meal of choice is, I want to be fair here. If you're doing that,
gotta be fair.
And then you get fat from it. Do you want to hear, hey, you lazy fuck, stop being fat and stop postmating Taco Bell? Or do you want to go, shit, I got a pretty good life here, I'm just going to keep ordering Taco Bell on my mom and dad's credit card while I live in their basement? No. It's very immediate. It's very short term. It's without a doubt self-destructive. But nobody understands anymore the discipline and the value of suffering, of just putting in a little bit of work and doing things that are a little hard to get a better payoff.
With the minimum delivery fee amount, how much Taco Bell do you have to order? Like, that's a double incentive to get fat, because you have to order like $18 worth of Taco Bell, which I think feeds a family of 20. I think by law.
And you're going to shit out half of that anyway, so you got to order another extra half on top of that. So
that's right.
You're going to order a lot of Taco Bell to get really fat.
Yeah. Well, speaking of...
I'm...
Oh, no, go ahead, James. Sorry.
I'm not on to perform my usual function on the show. I'm not on board with the idea that our moral decay has anything to do with the fact that life is getting easier. I don't think life really is getting easier, because the more good things you get, the more good things you're going to want. In order to actually achieve value in life, you need to advance from your current location. Now, it's true that if you want to have a passive mindset, it's easier than ever before to have that. But I think
that's what I'm saying.
There's all these services, but the problem isn't those services, because if you're if you're a really busy person, all of these services like the food delivery, that's great, because someone can, let's say I'm a computer programmer and I'm making, $150 an hour. I don't have time to go down to Taco Bell or I don't have time to go down to Chipotle, something a little more healthy. I don't have time. It's easier for someone who is less economically valuable than me to come and bring me food while I'm kicking ass and making $150 an hour. That's a great system, that we're striving for more good things with these services, but it's easier than ever before to be passive. But the problem isn't the services. It's this leftist. I mean, it's not just leftist, because you're seeing it on the right too now, but this mindset, that the anti-discipline, anti-effort mentality that said, well, I'm just a product of my environment, so no one can blame me if I have a passive mindset and don't advance myself and just take advantage of all these services and nothing else.
The point is well taken, James, but I hope at this point with the show, the listeners do understand that we're never going to attack innovations in what I would just call given tools. It's always the use of those tools, or the use of your mind in using those tools, is what we're attacking. So innovation per se, good. Being stagnant, both in your thinking or in your literally not moving off the couch, per se, bad. Okay.
Right, 100%. And before you move on, Daniel, one last point. I agree with everything you said, James. It's a difference between people saying, oh, everything seems immediately easier, therefore life is easier, and understanding that life is still a lot harder, that these are just concrete, simple things that are taken care of. And even in your example of quality, of ordering Taco Bell versus Chipotle, well, if you're making $150 an hour as a programmer, why aren't you paying someone to food prep for you and deliver that food prep to your work? You can get super healthy food that way if you're making that much money. So it's people don't even know the options that are available, because they're not even thinking of optimizing their life. There are self-esteem issues here, and there's things that Daniel just talked about and things that you just talked about.
Yeah.
Speaking of things I'm going to just talk about.
That was your weakest transition ever.
I've had weaker.
No, that's a good transition.
A Russian model in Thai jail promises to spill Trump-Russia secrets. I'll give you 15 guesses where this article is posted. CNN. Okay. A self-described Russian seductress is asking for U.S. help to escape a Thai detention center in exchange for information on alleged links between the president and Russia, according to her Instagram account. I want that to sink in for a moment. This is a CNN article.
I'm trying so hard not to laugh.
Sourced entirely from a Russian prostitute's Instagram account. Okay.
So Justin, is this the entire reason we're covering this story right now? Is because you just find it so funny that a CNN story is based on a Russian prostitute's Instagram account? Is that the entire shtick here?
I mean, that and a Midsider sent it in, so I thought that this was a good example of farce that a Midsider witnessed, and I wanted to include that to show that we are all in this witnessing the farce together. We are all individuals, but there's value in us commiserating and sharing our witnessing together. But Daniel, I think he kind of just asked the question for you, so I'm just gonna roll with that. Yeah, this is on here because this is an example of everything we've been talking about this entire episode, starting with the school shooting thing, of narratives and using what you need to push your narrative. I mean, will they let this Trump-Russia narrative die? No, they won't. And because they won't let it die, think about this woman in this jail before Instagram, right? Before Instagram, she would have been saying this. I have links in the Thai jail. I have evidence of Trump's links to Russia. And the Thai, you know, the Thai prison guards would have been like, this white bitch is crazy. And that would have been the end of it. She would have just been a nutcase in jail. But because social media amplifies insanity and people pick up on it, and then other insane people find that, further amplifying the insanity, and now ends up on CNN.com, and we now have to hear more about this Trump-Russia story, as if somehow, again, we still think that's how Trump won the election, not that you're all crazy, and people were sick of the Clintons. It's just, this story is so much of what is wrong with our culture right now.
It is so much that it's hard to focus on any one particular thing. I will make only this one minor point about just journalistic integrity, and it's based off entirely what you just said, which is crazy person says something aloud, not news. Crazy person says something on Instagram, news. Why?
Well, this is like when they have entire articles that are like, and you see this on NFL.com a lot. Oh, look at the NFL players' reactions to LeBron James' 50-point game. And then it's just tweets from different players. And it's like, if I wanted to know what these players thought about things that happened in the world, I would follow them. Or I would be friends with them in real life. Like, why is it news that human being who plays professional sports has opinion on something that another human being who plays professional sports did? That is not news. That is everyday what we would expect. And that's a question I have in general. Do we even know what is news anymore? It's in the name, right? News means new things that happened. All we report anymore is all the same things that are happening all the time.
Old.
I love this sentence buried in this story. Not at the end, but sort of like 67% of the way through. So that no one will see it. CNN contacted Rebecca after the report came out. This is the prostitute. But she failed to provide any evidence about Russian meddling in the U.S. election.
Can you imagine the reporter that did that and had to go home and talk to his wife? Hey, honey, what'd you do at work today? I called a prostitute. Why did you call a prostitute? Because she had evidence of Trump being linked to Russia. Do you think she then ended that marriage? That's not like that. Sounds like the worst lie ever.
One can only hope. How does someone who's not just a total psychopath, who's disconnected from reality, not write that sentence and then go, oh, maybe I should just delete the entire story? Because it's not a story.
The clicks, Daniels. The clicks, the Daniel. Deep,
I gotta say, the deep iron. One deep irony to this is when I clicked on this story when it was sent to me by Justin. The first thing that got in the way when I was trying to read it was this thing that said, like, Some reporter from CNN I vaguely recognize, like, with this really weird, cheesy smile saying, and then it says this caption, it says, do you want the facts and nothing but the facts? And then I'm just like, ugh, and I X'd it, and then I read this pile of garbage article.
That's right.
Both sides at this point have given up on honesty so much, it's just hard for me to even understand the situation they're in. Like, yeah, like, Daniel, you're psychologically putting yourself in the situation of the person, in the shoes, in the mind of the person writing this. And you write, oh, when we actually tried to interview the source, she failed to provide any evidence whatsoever. Wait a second. What's the rest of this fucking text doing here on our front page?
Right.
You know what would have been a better story?
That time I went to Thailand to bang a prostitute?
That's what I was going to say, something similar. I called a prostitute in Thai jail and here's what happened. That's a more interesting story. Right. How did you do that?
Belongs to BuzzFeed. How did you do that? Or Vice. But yeah, it's a much more interesting story.
Yeah.
Well, this is why people are reading BuzzFeed and Vice.
Yes.
Don't you want to know? Like, part of me is like, how did he call? Like, did he just call the prison and be like, hey, so we saw, like, this Instagram post, and one of your prisoners posted it. And first of all, how are you posting on Instagram? Like, what kind of prison is this? Like, is the prison that you must post on Instagram all day? Is that, I mean, because that's kind of hell. But so I don't know what kind of prison this is. But you're like, you call the guard, who, by the way, like, what are the odds they speak English in Thailand? Like, so you're calling them, you're like, Instagram, Russian, prostitute, Trump. And they just, how do you even know you talk to the model? Like, they're just like, all right, we got some fucking crazy American on the line here. Let's just you, can you do that female voice? Do that female voice. Like, right. Who do your Natasha impersonation? Like, how did this even happen from a reporting standpoint? I wonder if that's even a lie that he called and tried to find. He's just like, I'm just going to put that in there so my editor leaves me alone. Yeah, sure, I called the Thai prison. Fuck, how do you get a phone number for a Thai prison?
I had a journalist professor in undergrad who failed a classmate for writing a story in passive voice. I can't imagine what she would have done if she read that sentence.
All right, so it sounds to me like you guys are sick of everything, you're fed up, and you think maybe we should do something about it. Is that true?
Do we have to do something? Can't I just sit down for a while?
We're
that's how
out.
We became
we're
the just... fattest generation. All right, well, let's talk about a movie that addresses all of these points in The Hope for Romantic with JML. I saw Death Wish this week. It's Eli Roth's latest movie. It's starring Bruce Willis. And to start with, before I even review this, I have questions for you two. Daniel, do you like Bruce Willis?
Yes.
James, do you like movies with lots of gun violence?
Yes, absolutely. Including and especially the ones with Bruce Willis.
All right, then you guys will love this movie. End of review. Look, there's really nothing else to say about this movie, right? It's hard for me to even emotionally distance myself from this movie because intellectually, idea-wise, thematically, it stands so starkly from everything else that it's hard for me to just not be excited that this movie even exists. So the basic idea is Bruce Willis is this doctor in the trauma unit in Chicago's North Hospital, which we all know Chicago has so much gun violence. And they emphasize that. And he's constantly helping people. Until one night, the people who come in are his daughter and his wife because burglars broke into his house. They had seen them out one night. They were valeting him. They took a picture of his GPS, which had his home address in it. Which, by the way, all I could think of is maybe I'm just hypervigilant, but I was thinking of, why would you ever store your home address in your car so that random people who know, especially if you're rich, why would you do that so people could know where to go to steal shit? So that's the first mistake he made, but maybe that's just my paranoia and my hypervigilance. But so they find that, and one night when he's at work, they go in there and they attack his family and his wife. This is all obvious from the trailer, so I'm not spoiling anything. His wife gets shot. And his daughter gets put into a coma. So that's all established in the trailers. And the whole movie is basically a meditation on the idea of when the police fail, which is like, holy shit, this movie came out like 2 weeks after Parkland. When the police fail and the police can no longer protect you. And it actually makes the point in the movie, police only show up after the crime has been committed. So you have to protect yourself because police only clean up. They don't actually protect. Is it right to take justice into your own hand? So when government has failed, when police have failed, is it right to take government into your own hand? And the interesting thing about this movie is thematically, and this is high praise that I'm about to give it, thematically, this is a very Zack Snyder movie with the whole meditation. I could see this fitting very well in with the whole idea of Bruce Wayne's trauma leading him to be Batman and become a vigilante. There are very many parallels there, and it very much takes the side of efficacy of the individual and saying, yeah, it's right, and having sympathy and empathy for the main character. So that is the strengths of this movie. The strengths of this movie are, like we said, Bruce Willis, he's tremendous in this. Vincent D'Onofrio is tremendous in this. He never gets any respect for what he does, but he really nails the role, and his character plays a subtle importance in it. The gun violence is tremendous. I mean, to say that in the year 2018, like, people probably think I'm an asshole for saying that, but no, it's done well, and I enjoy seeing a movie with that in it. The other thing that is done well is the first part of the movie is tremendous. When it builds up his life, and you see their happiness, and then you see the crime be committed, and you see him in therapy and trying to struggle with it afterwards, all of that really establishes the mindset he's in when he then becomes the vigilante. So at that point, everything is done very well. The only thing is that visually, it's not as creative as a Zack Snyder movie. So you really understand the difference between a good visual director and a director like Eli Roth at that point. But everything else is done tremendously. The pacing of the movie, the score, the acting, everything is done well up until that point. But the problem is, what is Eli Roth known for? Do you guys know? What type of films does he make?
Isn't he the torture porn guy?
I mean, you could call it that, but he makes very campy ones. So I wouldn't really call it torture porn because the violence is very over the top and it's very fake.
No, hold now, on. Wait, is it Eli Roth who did Hostel?
I don't know. Google it. Figure it out and ombuds me. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Okay.
Spartacus?
So interrupt me when you figure that out. But he does stuff like that. He did Cabin Fever as well, if you remember that one, the horror movie with Ryder Strong, who played Sean Hunter on Boy Meets World. So he's done a lot of very campy movies like that. And when you start a movie that's very realistic emotionally and very realistic philosophically, and then when the violence starts, and even the violence at first is not over the top, but at a certain point, and I'm sure he was doing this intentionally, but it undercuts the movie when it becomes more campy towards the end. And that is my biggest sort of problem with the movie. So if you're not going to like the campiness of it, you're not going to enjoy it. But otherwise, it's a very good movie. And I think we've had some really good action movies come out as of late that aren't really getting the respect they deserve. I mean, obviously, last 6 months, like, Jumanji is top. We've talked about that before. But then under Jumanji, we have Den of Thieves. And then to me, it's a very close race between Death Wish and The Commuter because both have good themes. They're both old action stars doing what they're known for. And actually, in a way, Death Wish is sort of Bruce Willis's Taken. There's a lot of sort of similarities there. But I just think Death Wish is a little bit better than Commuter because I think it's more thematically integrated and delivers on its premise a little bit more. Although I personally would have written the story a little bit of a different way at the end. I don't want to explain that because I don't want to spoil it. But any midsiders out there who have seen it and want to talk to me about that and wonder what I'm talking about, you can hit me up on Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, at The Midside. And one final note before we move on to Trailer Takedown here. If there are any movies you want to hear me review or hear us do a Patreon exclusive review for, go to themidside.com/movie list. You can see a list of movies that are on there to possibly review in the future. Ones near the top will get reviewed. And you can also submit movies you would like to see reviewed. I get a lot of people sending in movies they want to hear us talk about or TV shows. You can do it that way, themidside.com/movie list.
I wanted to add one more thing about Death Wish.
Mm-hmm. Eli Roth thing first, Daniel.
He did, in fact, direct Hostel, which is the only thing I knew him from. So he's done a lot of stuff, but his first big hit was Hostel.
Right. And, well, Cabin Fever was before Hostel. He was also, Daniel, the Bear Jew in Inglorious Bastards.
Yeah, I knew
did
that,
you know that?
Too. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Last James? Thing here from me, Rotten Tomatoes score 15%, audience score
shocking
84%.
Okay. I have a rule in my life, and I think it should be a mid-side rule. What'd you say, James?
That's exactly what I was going to bring up. And yes, we should make a rule out of this.
Right. If a movie has that much of a disparity between the Rotten Tomatoes review and the audience review, then it needs to be seen at least out of intellectual curiosity to see what that is. And I will say this. I was very surprised at the diversity in the theater, because if you remember when we talked about this trailer, people were talking about it being alt-right and everything. There was, every race was in that theater, literally. I'm not even kidding. There was Muslim. There was, that's a religion, but you know what I mean. So whatever, what race is that? Arabic? Arab, that's a
just stop. Just move on.
That's
please.
That's a language. Okay. There was black. There was Hispanic. There was Asian. There was every race in that theater. I was very surprised at that with the way the movie has been marketed. But I think more people feel this way than anyone cares to admit. James, what were you going to say?
Oh, no. I was going to point out the Rotten Tomatoes score.
Yeah.
Sorry to steal your thunder there, James.
And that is a rule, and I suspect that this, I think it's becoming more, it seems like it's becoming more and more prevalent now that, like, people are just blowing their load over, or rather not people, but critics are simply blowing their load over movies or just ignoring movies based on what they think they're supposed to do after the preview comes out. Like, Get Out, oh, this talks about race. We better appear intellectually, you know, deep and, like, really just blow our load over this movie. A film for the ages, it said. And then this gets ignored. Because they said...
Well, it's what
it
you said.
Right.
It's all agenda-driven.
Yeah.
Like I said,
you can't separate
I tried to be as objective
anymore.
Right. And I tried to be as objective as possible talking about this movie when I'm talking about how the pacing at the beginning was great and everything, and it becomes more campy, and, you know, I would have made a minor change to the ending. That's me trying to be as objective as possible, but these critics aren't trying to do that anymore. They see Get Out, which is, Get Out is a terrible movie, okay? Look, the basic premise of, like, oh yeah, like, they're appropriating black culture, and we're going to literally show them appropriating black culture. Like, okay, like, that's a cool concept, but everything about the execution of that movie is absolutely terrible. From the way they concretize it into, we're going to take black bodies and put white brains into them. Like, that's just fucking retarded. And then, now you got me on a Get Out rant, but whatever. And then even the technical filmmaking in that is poorly executed. So there's nothing even objective about what's going on as far as the analysis anymore. All right, I think that's a natural endpoint there. And I will say, I think a couple of the things we're going to talk about today in Trailer Takedown fall right into this discussion we're having. So let's continue this discussion.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Fahrenheit 451 is HBO's adaptation of the Ray Bradbury novel starring Michael B. Jordan and Michael Shannon. Michael B. Jordan, of course, is coming off of his role in Black Panther, which was a huge hit, which maybe this is, he's finally getting some redemption. For me, I'm going to talk about this a little bit first. I think this looks really interesting, and I think we're starting to see, last week I reviewed Heathers, and now we're talking about this. I think we're starting to see some of the backlash against social justice. When I look at this trailer and I see Michael Shannon playing a similar character that he played it to Zod in Man of Steel, and then he says the line in the trailer, we are not born equal and we must be made equal through fire or through flame or whatever the exact line is.
By the flame, yeah.
By the fire.
Yeah.
Could you more concretize social justice into one line? And he's playing the authoritarian government figure who's encouraging censorship, which is the burning of books. I'm assuming everyone out there knows the story of Fahrenheit 451, so I don't really want to summarize it. When I see that in a trailer, and the fact that that's getting made by HBO with major stars in it, such as Michael Shannon, and again, Michael Shannon's reprising that Zod role, it's very similar to Zod, that tells me that we're starting to get that backlash. And that makes me very excited. And I personally am very excited for this because of the talent involved. And that one line tells me they get it and they're not going to try and twist the book into something else for their movie. Major hug.
I wish I could be as optimistic. I still, to not bury the lead, I'm going to pretty strongly hug this, not only because I like Fahrenheit 451, because the trailer looks tremendous. Michael Shannon plays the best collectivist villain on the planet right now. But to sort of echo something James said earlier, it's like, I just can't enjoy anything. Because yeah. I just keep thinking about, like, how are they going to mess this up? How are they going to take out the anti-collectivist message from this? How are they going to turn it into something where equality at the end of the day is a good thing, or certain ways of going about equality is a bad thing, but equality per se is still good, and we'll go about it in different ways or whatever it is. Like, I just keep thinking they're going to destroy it. But that's me being cynical. Me. I'm still going to watch. It looks great.
Hug!
Okay, so to answer your point, I think they preserve the individuality in it by doing one thing, by casting Michael B. Jordan. By making the lead black, people will not get as mad because they will take it as a statement on race and about making black people stand out from white people. Whereas if you had a white person in the lead, you would have seen the backlash like you did against Death Wish, where it's, oh, it's not individualism, it's individualism for white people. So that's why I think they cast Michael B. Jordan in the role. And I think that answers your concern. I have no idea.
I'll look it up.
Look James. It up while James talks. Go ahead, James.
I want to be optimistic like Justin, but I definitely have some worries like Daniel. I'm just going to go in and enjoy what I can. So tentative hug. Hug.
How did I become the optimistic one on this show?
It's me. Weird.
It's weird.
I don't know.
It's weird.
As I've said before, it's not even that I'm an optimist or a pessimist. It's just that I never really expected that much to begin with. So anything I do get, I'm happy with. So does that make me a cynic or an optimist? I don't know.
It's being directed by Raman Barani.
Wow.
I've never heard of.
Those are two different foods I really like. Ramen and biryani. Like, ramen is in the Japanese noodles, and then biryani is in, like, the Persian rice dish. Like, that's his
Now you're
name.
Explaining your own jokes.
Pretty close.
Yes, thank you.
Top ramen. Yeah. He's done literally nothing I've heard of. I'm looking at his directing credits. He's directed a bunch of documentaries. This is his breakout, so we'll have no idea.
And his he's directing another documentary then.
Are very, it's hard for me to tell what they're about. Or one of them is literally called Plastic Bag. I'm assuming that's about plastic bags.
Very naturalistic.
Yeah. So don't know. Could be top ramen or bottom ramen. We don't know. We'll see.
I mean, I guess since he's accustomed to directing documentaries, it's only fair that he directs a documentary about the future of free speech. So
I literally just made that joke when I said, so he's directing another documentary. Oh, let's just move on.
No one heard you. Speak louder.
Second trailer.
Paterno is another HBO movie. This one stars Al Pacino as Joe Paterno, the now deceased Penn State football coach who found himself embroiled in controversy after it came out that one of his staff members had been sexually assaulting young men at his institution. If you remember the controversy, people wanted to keep him, such as the people at the university, but other people said he must have known and must have covered it up, and therefore he should be basically executed. That was the fervor at the time. For me, for this specific trailer, I think this fits in perfectly with what we were just talking about. I think that Fahrenheit 451 will not get good reviews. But I think this one, which looks like terrible naturalistic nonsense, will get amazing reviews because it's revealing the truth behind the patriarchy and the corruption and the blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
All I know is Al Pacino was not convincing as Joe Paterno, and then they tried to do that, like, emotionally resonant scene at the end of the trailer, and I was just like, all right, I want nothing to do with this. This is going to be terrible. It's going to be a twisting of reality. It's not even going to actually tell you what happened. I want nothing to do with this. Tackle.
Tackle. Daniel?
Unlike Justin, I kind of like this kind of docudrama based on recent events. They do tend to be naturalistic, but I don't think they can get super naturalistic because they're necessarily a dramatization of reality in a certain sense versus something like Black Swan, which can get sort of super hyper naturalistic. So it will be naturalistic. That doesn't mean it has to be bad per se. I think there can be decent naturalism. I'm interested. I'm going to watch this. Al Pacino looks interesting. The one sort of thing I'll say about Al Pacino and his portrayal of anyone, he has the same voice. Like, it's just Al Pacino's voice, no matter who he portrays. So that's a little weird. But other than that, I'm in. I'm curious.
Hug!
James?
To agree with you, Justin, yeah, I tend to not like these sorts of docudramas. I know even sort of the ones directed by Clint Eastwood, I can only get into so much. Although I don't know if there's so much docudramas. I'm thinking mainly of the movie Changeling. Have either of you seen that?
No.
Nope.
It's a movie about this woman who her son got lost, and the FBI. The LAPD gave her a different child and they kept trying to convince her that it was her own child. But obviously she knew it wasn't. And it was just this big corruption scandal that the LAPD was trying to cover up somehow by giving her the wrong child. And it was just like a straightforward portrayal of all these injustices that occurred. And I always just kind of felt like, oh, well, whatever most people find interesting about just the depiction of events here, I just don't find that interesting. Like, okay, like a severe injustice happened. All right. Like I know, like, you know, this reads to me as one of those. So tackle. And although Changeling was a good movie, but it's just not the type of movie I like, though. Not to, you know, insult Clint Eastwood there.
Final trailer.
Ralph Breaks the Internet. Wreck-It Ralph 2 is, as it is in the name, the sequel to Wreck-It Ralph. Wreck-It Ralph was, of course, the premise about the video game characters all come to life. Sort of, as I've mentioned before, people took the Toy Story premise, which is that when you're not around, the toys come to life and have their own lives and blah, blah, blah. Well, they took that premise and they applied it to the inside of video games. Of course, remember I had a problem with the end of Wreck-It Ralph where it's like, oh, well, you just have to accept your role in the grand scheme of things that you're a bad guy. And some people just have to be bad guys because we all have our role to play in society. Thank you, communism. So I do have problems with that. But this one is his arcade game. Or I think the arcade in general, because his friend there, the Sarah Silverman voice character, the little girl, is in there as well. They get plugged into the internet. And of course, just like the first one where you see all the different games, here he sees all the different sort of websites and things like that. And it just becomes him going throughout the internet. Now, for me, everything I loved about the first movie was still here. The animation is tremendous in this trailer. I loved it. And then the ending of this trailer where, what was it, the pancakes and the what other, what were the two things? The pancakes milkshakes. And something else?
Milkshakes.
And the pancakes and the milkshake, and it's one of those stupid fucking like Flappy Bird games where you just do the one way or the other, and Ralph starts playing it from inside of the game, and then his friend brings out all the pancakes, and he just keeps giving the pancakes to the bunny. And his friend is like, I think it's time that you give the milkshake, or you start feeding the whatever the other kitten, and the kitty is like, but pancakes go to the bunny. Like I thought that was hilarious at the end. I was laughing hysterically. So I know I'm probably going to hate the ideas behind this movie, but I think it's well made enough that it's worth seeing the animation and the humor and also the voice acting. So I'm hugging this.
Hug. Daniel?
It's animation. Wreck-It Ralph was an excellent movie despite the ending salute to Karl Marx. So I'm going to see this. Hug. 3 for 3.
Hug.
That's rare for you, Daniel.
Super.
James?
This was funny. The jokes about the internet were really funny. I didn't get the bunny kitty joke, and I was a little grossed out by the pop at the end. And then the kid screaming. That was just wasn't funny to me. But as he's going around, and
how do you not get the joke?
Is the joke about the simple mindedness of people who play a game like that? Like, oh, well, the pancakes right. go to the bunny. That's how it. I don't know. I've right. never played a game.
It's
like
making
that, so.
Fun of those simple games that have everyone addicted to them, like Flappy Bird, where all you do is punch the screen. And then the joke is you add the element of realism that if you actually fed a bunny that many pancakes, it would explode. That's why it's funny.
All right, I believe you. The joke I did find really funny is like how he's like walking through the streets and like people are going up to him saying like, hey, do you want to increase your penis size? Like, and like asking him things that like the internet tends to ask you. And he's like, oh, maybe. Yeah. And then the little girl's like, no, you don't want that. I thought that was pretty funny. They didn't ask him. It's a kid's movie. They didn't ask him if he wanted his dick bigger. Maybe they put stem cells into it, but
it's like, wait,
it was
minute.
Something. It was.
Did you get the Red Band Wreck-It Ralph trailer?
Yeah.
That's the Red Band one is where it goes directly to RedTube.
Yeah. Right. Or YouTube Red, which is the same thing.
All right, James, hug or tackle?
So hug. Hug, hug, hug.
Hug!
Justin, did you watch the Emoji Movie?
No. As much as I like TJ Miller, I will not burn myself to watch that movie. Did you?
I was super curious and kind of sick one weekend, so I did.
And at the end you were more sick?
It's fairly dumb, but they do sort of a depiction of your phone and the internet that I thought was creative, like the metaphor was creative, and how they did it was creative, and this looked basically like a ripoff of that, so I'm interested to see how it will be different. Now, I'm not saying they literally ripped them off, they're probably developing them independently, almost at the same
time. Right, first to market.
Yeah, so I'm curious to see the similarities and differences in the portrayals.
Right, the Emoji Movie heard that Wreck-It Ralph was doing... the Emoji Movie smacks of hearing that Wreck-It Ralph was doing this in their sequel and trying to beat them to market, is what that smacks of.
Yeah, much like Ants beat A Bug's Life to market.
100%, that's a great comparison. Was TJ Miller at least funny?
Yeah.
All right, not seeing the movie. And that reaction is the reaction I have every time that I read Reddit. So I'm going to share that with all of you listeners out there. It's time for Reddit on Reddit.
These things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma, boring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't post it, but we will repost it.
First Reddit. Men of Reddit, when was the last time you got a compliment and what was it for? Now, I think we've talked about this topic before. So I want to take this in a different direction and I want to ask you guys something. Do adults just don't give compliments, right? And what I mean by that is like compliments are something that kids worry about, right? And they're all nice to each other and like posting on their Instagrams and stuff. But as adults, it's just not like people don't go around giving each other compliments, right? Because people are, they have self-esteem and they're independent and they're proud of their stuff on their own. You know, affirmation's nice and like, hey, good job. But like compliments just aren't a part of adult life. Or am I crazy?
I think you're crazy.
It's different from my experience.
Okay. Wildly well, then that experience. Answers that. That answers that. All right.
This goes back to Justin's family issues. Like, it's totally normal for your mom to beat you with a shoe, right? Like, everyone's parents just beat them with shoes, right? Like, that's
I
not...
want to be clear. I want to be clear. I've never once claimed I was physically abused. Thank you. Just
no,
want to
that.
Put that
I'm
out
just,
there.
I'm being dramatic. Your mother would never beat you with a shoe. It'd be more like a hoagie or... I don't know. I like your mom.
No, it would be more she would be like, why are you wearing that shoe? Like, why did you decide to wear that shoe? And then constantly for the next 2 weeks talk about that shoe.
I like your mom. I'm not trying to imply that she literally beat you, but...
No, but you want to know something funny relevant to what you're talking about?
What?
Randomly, my mom texted me, because I was back there in January for the AFC Championship game, and randomly she texted me, and she was like, where's your tattoo say again? And I was like, why are you guys talking about my tattoo? And she's like, well, what do you think we talk about? Like, your dad just asked me, like, do you remember what Justin's tattoo said? And my mom was like, I don't know, I'll ask him. So I just texted them a picture of my tattoo so they can never, like, ask about it and talk about it again. They just, like, fixate on these things. It's like, oh, that's something we wouldn't do and is different. Let's fixate on it. Anyway.
You should have gotten a tattoo that read, why are you talking about my tattoo? You made that conversation way funnier.
Just literally.
College Justin would have done that, but adult Justin doesn't do things like
so,
that.
So, Justin, I get and give compliments all the time. I
give
you
me
compliments
examples
all the time. Do you not hear
do
them?
Do you? Apparently not. Apparently I'm mental filtering. Because usually my conversations with you are, I say something and you're like, yeah, that's true. Why are we talking about this? That is how I remember our conversations.
Well, it's interspersed in the me going, yes. Our compliments, fairly regularly, as well as...
Do I not understand what a compliment is? Is this one of these concepts I never learned as a children, like as a child, like love?
That's right, affection, unconditional love. Yeah. I don't know, like, especially at work, in a work context, I make a huge point to make sure that I compliment people on their work daily.
Yeah. That's the main place where I'm giving and receiving compliments is at work.
Yeah.
Just because it's so important.
Yeah. I got a compliment yesterday.
To let people you're working with know that they're doing it right. And then,
but they're not
experience what, well, I mean, maybe that's it. I don't give them out loosey goosey. I only give the compliments when I really think the student is doing a good job or if the parent is making a really good decision regarding, you know, the education of their child. Like I'll say like, oh, you're doing the right thing by sending your kid to private school. Like I'll the sort of I guess that's not really a compliment.
Wait, that's a compliment? Like, see, I'm confused. To me, that's a statement of reality. I do that when kids are doing
one.
Well. I go, yeah, you're following the method. You'll get a good score. Like, is that a compliment? Because to me, that's just a statement of reality.
Well, that's, I don't know. That seems a little different, but I often tell the student like, oh, that's a really good question. That shows me that you're thinking about the topic in X way, and X is a good way to be thinking about the topic because,
yeah.
And you know, like it's like it's stuff like that.
I think it's important.
So I'm really good at giving compliments then, because I do that all the time when I'm tutoring.
I think it's important to distinguish between acknowledging what a thing is and turning it into a compliment. So that is a good point, Justin. Just saying like, oh yeah, you asked a question. Like that's not a compliment, right? But like you asked a particularly good question. Would be a compliment. But if like someone just does what they're supposed to do where I work, I don't compliment them. But if they do what they're supposed to do and they come up with some innovation in doing it or they do it ahead of schedule or something, then I will compliment them on that.
Yeah.
But aren't kids supposed to ask good questions? And isn't this is the problem I'm having right now. Like a student asks a good question. Isn't that just a fact of reality that that's a good question?
No.
Like pointing out, oh, that's a good question. That actually helps explain this other thing, which will help you even more. Is that complimenting that student or is that just stating a fact of reality
you,
that, oh, that's a good question?
You must have had students who have asked terrible questions.
Well, yeah. And then I go, that's a terrible question. You already know the answer to that.
That's well, that would
and
be,
I'm not joking. I say that.
That's fine. And that's not a compliment. See how that works? Like, and give me the compliment. Works a couple different ways. One is it rewards psychologically the person for doing something well, and two is it demonstrates to other people what is good within that context.
Yeah.
So.
I guess I'm having trouble distinguishing between a compliment and a statement of reality.
A statement of reality would be you just asked a question. Which is useless.
But isn't the question being good a statement of reality? Oh, that's a good question. That's a statement of reality.
A proper compliment would be
a statement, a good question,
a type of statement about reality. Like, an improper compliment is a lie, but, like, it's not just a statement of reality. It's also, it's not just a statement of fact. It's also a statement of value. You're saying, like, I appreciate, it improves my life that you did this. You know, like, and there's a sense of you know, great gratitude for it. That's part of what a compliment is like gratitude. You want to express this emotional thing. And my students like get that because I'm very critical. When they do it wrong, like I point out the 30 billion things they did wrong. So when they get something, when they see that they've really fundamentally gotten something right, they're like, oh shit, like, you know, James has really high standards. Like, I must have really nailed it if I actually like reached those standards. And that happens a lot, but you know, a lot of criticism happens first. And so it's like, there's very much a sense of, you know, gratitude and achievement that comes with that, even though it is just a fact that they did it.
Except, yeah.
This therapy session brought to you by Reddit.
I tend to think of a compliment as exceptionally valuable for a reason. And I tend to think of it that way. So I, mm-hmm. when I give a compliment, I try not to do what I was giving it as an example of, so that maybe that was a bad example, right? Just don't say, that's a good question. I would say, that's a good question because, and tell them why it's a good question. Mm-hmm. Or at work, you know, that's an excellent design because it follows, you know, it's these principles or whatever it is.
Okay, so what I've learned today is no one gives me compliments, but I'm very good at giving them.
You're horrible at listening. That's something you learned. Huh?
Sorry, my girlfriend's talking in the other room saying she gives me compliments. Okay, so apparently I've now pissed off my best friend and my girlfriend. So let's move on, all right? Next Reddit. What do you think was the most awkward first person to try blank and tries to convince other people to try it situation in history? And the reason I included this in Reddit is, like, I've always thought about things like that, right? Like, so I've always heard the first time you smoke weed, you don't get high. So what I want to know is, who was the first person to try to smoke weed twice and then try to convince somebody else to smoke weed twice?
Yeah.
That's insane to me. Like, oh, this doesn't work. You're just going to put this piece of grass in your mouth and light it one more time. Then it'll work. Like, or licking toads. Supposedly licking certain toads gets you high. Who's like, I'm going to lick this toad. And then how do you convince somebody else, hey, if you lick this toad, it'll feel really good.
I've got one. It's not that strange, but I've got one, which is lobster. Here, eat this sea bug. But it's,
well,
really
this tastes
hard.
The sea bug.
And it would break my
and then
teeth.
Some, who's the first person who dipped it in butter, too? They were like, yeah, this doesn't really have a taste, but what if we try dipping it in this thing?
That's right. Also, if you like lobster slathered in butter, don't you just like butter?
Yes. You like paying lots of money for butter is what you like.
I like my butter delivered inefficiently on a sea monster.
Worth 10 times its amount. Worth 10 times its value.
I want to lick this butter off of pink meat. Yeah. It's weird. I'm sure.
So,
certain sexual acts were probably fairly awkward to convince other people to try.
Yeah, that's the other thing I was thinking of, like anal sex. Who was the first person who was like, "Let's try this," and you got someone else to do it?
It's probably weird.
Like, think about that.
I don't really want to think about it, but it's pretty weird.
To boost off Justin's first, who thought it was a good idea to light plant matter on fire and then inhale the smoke?
Yeah.
Like, how did you think of that? Like, just the general institution of smoking, like, how did that come about? Like,
I have to think, James, the best solution I've come up with to answer that is, uh-huh, I have to think that a field accidentally got lit on fire and then somebody standing in it with the smoke got high. That's what I have to think happened.
And they're like, I gotta reproduce this
right
experience.
Right.
That's right. And
yeah,
economize it, because we can't
understand.
Always be lighting our fields on fire to get high.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly.
Right, yeah. Just make it a small version of that.
How about, they do this on Plebes, the show, but blue cheese. Here, this milk has gone bad and then it rotted. Eat this. Yeah.
Well, it's the same thing with croutons, right? Let's put stale bread on a salad. Like, who's thought that was a good idea and convinced other people to eat it?
A lot of foods. A lot of foods are like this. Whiskey, I mean, it's a little more straightforward, but it's just, it's like, I mean, this isn't awkward or anything. It's just like, oh shit, if you leave it in the barrel, it turns brown and starts tasting really good. Like, we should do more of that. And like, now there's a whole science in aging it. So.
Well, yeah, well, that was another one of somebody's stupid nephew left it there for too long and then then drank it by accident. And everyone's like, wow, you actually did something yeah. worthwhile.
Yeah,
that's what that was.
Yeah. All right. That's fun.
All right. Yep.
Last Reddit. If your employer gave you the option to work 10-hour days Monday through Thursday instead of 8-hour days Monday through Friday, would you do it? Why or why not? Does it say why not, why not? It says why not, actually. Reddit. Assume my answer, Reddit, huh? How dare you assume my answer?
Why not? Don,
triggered!
Don Draper response here. Only 10-hour days? Excellent. Reduce the amount of time I work. Fantastic.
Oh, is that your serious answer?
Lately, it's a very busy season for me right now, and like 10 would be a blessing.
It's the nonprofit busy season where lots of people are not making profits.
That's right. We have so much profit to not make. It's really difficult this time of year. We got to hit our quota of not making money. We have so many widgets not boy. To sell. Yeah.
I kind of have the Don Draper response, which is just like, I don't know. I work about 10 hours every day, just 10 hours every day about like just doing one thing or another, either doing research or tutoring or like, I don't know. I just don't consider work to be like, oh, the shit you have to do. Like this, the mid-side is work for me, but like not in the negative sense. It's just more stuff, more productive activity I'm engaging in. So if you count that, I work about 10 hours a day, every day.
Well, if you like, count all that, I don't really ever not work. Like,
yeah.
Going to the gym would be work in that sense then.
Just like productive activity as opposed to like, you know,
recreation. I feel like you just said the gym is not a productive activity. That's what I feel like was like the undercurrent of what you just said.
The gym isn't productive?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess I count the gym in that 10 hours, which I don't know if you should. Yeah.
Daniel, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that this feels like it only applies to people who, you know, pack boxes of chocolate for a living.
Right. Or, yeah.
You know, stamp license plates. 'Cause intellectual work or white collar work or whatever you want to refer to it as, like, there are weeks when I work 70 hours and there are weeks when I work 30 hours. And it's just what I want from an employer is the flexibility so that they know that I have goals. I have things I need to accomplish. And sometimes it's going to take me a lot longer than 40 hours a week to accomplish them. And sometimes it won't. And so, you know, having set hours per day and then you get a 3-day weekend or whatever, like none of that matters to me. What I'd rather have is the flexibility to accomplish goals.
Right. So to say that in another way and back you up, it's about doing work. It's not about the amount of time. This question is rooted in the Marxist labor theory of value. And that's the amount of effort you exert equals the amount of work you did. And that is not true. It's about what you produce and the amount of value you produce. So if you can produce value in 5 minutes, then you worked for 5 minutes. That's all that matters. Both of your answers to the question were based upon the idea that any time you spend producing value is considered work because you're looking at it as activity that you're creating value, not the amount of time you've spent doing something. And this question just comes from that faulty premise that I'm sick of. I'm sick of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a very damaging premise.
If my employer would allow me to only work 10 hours Monday through Thursday, when I had to wear a tie, that would be tremendous. That would be a huge upgrade to my life.
All for casual Fridays. I'm all for casual Fridays.
We
all
have
right, gentlemen.
Business casual Fridays, which is
oh my like, god,
defeats the purpose.
So it's like you can wear the same stuff, but just don't wear a tie.
Right.
It's terrible.
DC.
I'm like all pro companies until they do things like that. And then I'm like the most like anti like HR person, like fighting the man. Like all I want is flexibility and dress code. That's all I want. It's really all I want.
Remember when I caused a near revolution at the place we used to mutually work because I wore a suit and a t-shirt?
Yeah.
I thought the place was going to be set on fire.
Yeah.
It was anarchy after that.
Basically.
All right, gentlemen. That's enough of that jibber jabber. What did we learn this trip? Daniel?
I learned that if I want to make national news, all I have to do is Instagram something. As long as it bashes Trump in some way or says that Russia cost Hillary Clinton the election, I will make it. I have a greater than 50% chance of making CNN. So I'm going to get on that.
It's true. It's true, James.
I learned that because I don't like the smell of poop, it means I'm an authoritarian. Which didn't Jordan Peterson already beat them to this point? Like, I remember Jordan Peterson saying, like, when you look at what Hitler was saying to a lot of his men, he had a preoccupation with cleanliness. He talked a lot about cleaning his hands and the Virgin Mary and, you know, and lobsters, you know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Gulag Archipelago, read it.
I feel like you just did a straw man of Jordan Peterson in 15 seconds. I feel like that's what that was.
Yeah, I did.
That was awesome. Justin, what did you learn?
I learned that apparently I am still terrible at understanding human interaction. Thanks, Mom and Dad.
Who gives compliments?
What's a compliment?
That's just reality. Well, if you want to give us a compliment, especially Justin, who apparently needs it, you can... find us at The Midside on all the social medias, Twitter, Facebook,
Instagram.
Wait,
I think I just realized, when my girlfriend gives me a compliments, but I don't think it's appropriate to say on a podcast.
No, I see. That's a sex joke.
She just said, shut up.
Yeah. Hilarious. Twitter, Facebook.
That's funny. Snapchat. That's funny. If you don't think that's funny, fuck off. All right.
You're like the Bostonian version of Larry the Cable Guy.
I just did that.
It's funny. I don't care who you are out there. Yeah. Social media, fine. Website, themidside.com/podcast, where you can get all the podcasts that we've ever done, ever, because that's a lot of podcasts. Midside.com/store, where you can get your False Dichotomy Bro t-shirt, or your Hail Snyder t-shirt, or your classic logo t-shirt. All up in there, or you can tell a friend about the show. We love telling friends. Friends are the number one people who we like to tell things. And if you have friends, you should tell them about this show. It's how we grow.
Tell them how awesome they are, because they need compliments.
Give them a compliment. That's right. And you can
give our show a compliment.
Give our show a compliment by telling a friend. That's right. And let's see. While you're subscribing on iTunes or Google Play, you can also give us a 5-star review there. 5-star reviews help us pass people like Welcome Night Vale, whatever the hell that is. And we want to thank Liberty.me for syndicating us to all the libertarians out there, Ron Paul 2020. And then finally, Patreon.com/...
Wait. What are you talking about? I'm voting for The Rock.
The Midside. I'm not saying I'm voting for Ron Paul. I'm saying he should run in 2020, because any election without Ron Paul is not really an election, in my opinion.
Okay.
Where was I? Why you derail me like that,
Patreon.
Man? Of course we're voting for The Rock. Patreon. Everyone knows that. we need campaign t-shirts for The Rock up on themidside.com/store.
Oh, I have a lot of free time all of a sudden. I'll do that.
That's right. Patreon.com/themidside. Patreon's a platform where you can support the show financially by choosing to give us a few bucks every time we create a piece of content. That's right. It's not a monthly subscription. It's not going to be automatically deducted if we do nothing, if we run off to the Bahamas and produce no content. No money deducted. The end. So helps us keep the lights on, helps us run advertisements, and it will eventually help us support The Rock's political ambitions. So if you can afford it, we appreciate it. We thank and love all of our Patreon subscribers. In fact, if you become a Patreon subscriber, you will get Patreon exclusive content. including but not limited to reviews of The Last Jedi and 1517 to Paris, right, Justin?
Yes.
And others. So check that
More
out.
More reviews coming, and also a Bill Burr-style podcast featuring me and only me coming probably this week.
Oh, Bill Burr-style. Yelling. The microphone and your interracial girlfriend. Okay.
That's what just happened.
Thanks so much, and until next time, we love you lots.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Evelizeski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a very clean day. Very clean indeed.